Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, not on a Saturday night, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 304 of Registry Matters. Larry, how are you this afternoon? How are you? What's up?
Doing awesome. I'm glad we could do this today so my Saturday doesn't have to be absorbed with podcasts. Thank you.
Is it really that much of a burden to do the podcast?
Well, it takes a big part of my weekend away, as I would like to be doing other things.
I've offered to do it on a different day of the week. We could do it on a different day so it doesn't destroy your weekend.
But then I would have to quit doing the things I have responsibilities for. So I just have too many things on my plate.
God, can't win with you ever. Chance, how are things over there on the West Coast? I'm sure it's a lovely, fine, beautiful day, 75 or 80 degrees. Everything good over there?
Yeah, just happy to be here. Yeah, very good.
Perfect. Well, welcome back. Hey, everybody, remember to press like and subscribe. Leave 5-star reviews. All that happy horse stuff. Also, thumbs up the episode. Go over to YouTube. Do me a favor. You don't have to do anything else. You don't even have to listen to it if you don't want to. If you've made it this far, go to YouTube and press like on the video. Without anything else going on, Larry, what are we doing tonight?
Well, we have a case from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, a PFR case out of Tennessee. And then, of course, we're going to have a California corner with Chance Oberstein. And then we have part two of the listener letter from Daniel, which should be interesting. And we have a question and a listener comment. We have a couple articles of good news if we get that far. And we're going to try to keep this compact tonight because, as I understand it, our Eastern partner has an obligation this evening that they need to take care of.
That is correct. I have other obligations and I can't get out of it. And that's why we couldn't record the rest of the weekend because, well, you know, holiday and all that. So that's what's going to happen. Larry, do you want to tell me about one of your new general rules?
Yes, I do. I was coming back from Las Cruces traveling on Interstate 25 and I heard this story on the radio and happened in Albuquerque. So as a general rule, if you pull a weapon, I would suggest this. If you're going to pull a weapon, please don't. But if you're going to pull a weapon on a police officer and you don't get shot dead, which this person did not, the police officer discharged the weapon, but the person didn't die. I would suggest that you do not send a family member back to the scene to try to locate the weapon that you tossed before the police caught up with you.
Okay, that seems reasonable, but like continue on with the story. Like, why wouldn't you do that?
Well, this person, it was an interesting story. The weapon was stolen and the person was a convicted felon and the person was on pretrial release. And during the interrogation, after being apprehended and not being dead, the person admitted that they had pulled a BB gun on the police. And then the wife went back to try to find the weapon where it had been tossed and asked the property owner if she could conduct a search for her husband's property. And the person said no, and they called the police. And the police thought, well, gee, if there's someone wanted to search that property in that area, they linked it together to an incident. And they said, well, we'll be happy to come search your property with your permission. And they came and found the weapon. So a whole lot of new charges were stacked. Now, we have an attorney here, and my theory would be that if the police were unable to find that weapon, and maybe months went by and they never located the weapon, the police would never be able to have been able to prove it was a real weapon. And, of course, had he not made the statement that he even pulled a BB gun on the police, then the case against him would be less strong than it is presently. It said, Chance, would you see any flaws in my logic, or does that make any sense he shouldn't have done?
No, that makes perfect sense. You know, you don't want to help anybody convict you. Yes, that makes perfect sense.
So he kind of did the same thing that the poor young lady in Georgia on the beach did. He made a case that was somewhat weak. He made it very strong by helping the police locate the weapon and by admitting to the police that he'd pulled a weapon. But please, folks, don't pull a weapon on the police. You're going to end up dead. And beyond that, you shouldn't pull a weapon on the police or anybody else for that matter.
It seems reasonable, Larry.
So.
All right, then. Well, so there was that. And then we have a question from Darren. And this just came in over YouTube pretty recently. And I guess it's kind of a little bit open-ended, but I think you can fill it in. It says, in regards to 247, I don't remember which episode he posted this on, Larry. Do you remember which episode it was?
I don't offhand.
All right. Anyway, it's pretty recent. But he says, what are the correct vehicles to challenge the registry, Larry? Could we get some suggestions or examples other than declaratory judgment?
Well, you're right. That is an open question. And let's just take some guesses here. If he wants to just challenge the registry, quote, the registry, because he doesn't think the registry should exist, that's going to be almost an impossible challenge to make because we have controlling case law that says registration is constitutional, meaning that it's on its face, it's not unconstitutional. The mere act of registering is not unconstitutional on its face. And facial means that there's no set of circumstances where you could validly operate a registration program. Well, we operate registration programs all throughout the country that are very valid and very constitutional. And some of them you do not get to opt in by committing a crime like registering, like being a young man between 18 and 26, you will register for the draft or you would be subject to penalties. And there's nothing unconstitutional about that. But if he wants to challenge the registry, I would say first would be to try to focus on what aspect of the registry you want to challenge. And the declaratory judgment is going to be, in my view, the appropriate vehicle in most instances, but not always. You could also make a challenge through a criminal case. For example, if a new aspect was added to the registry and it became effective or was going to become effective, well, you could use a declaratory judgment and seek an injunction if you wanted to try to prevent the implementation. Or when it became effective, you could tell the police, kind of like a person in Georgia did named Mr. Park, that what was a GPS challenge. Georgia said you will have to be fitted for a GPS the rest of your life beyond your supervision. And Mr. Park said when his supervision finished, he told them they could take their GPS and shove it. And they said, well, that's fine. We'll prosecute you. And he says, we'll prosecute away. And he made the challenge within a criminal action. I don't like doing challenges within a criminal case because my theory of judges that are handling criminal cases is they think you're whining. When you bring in a case that's been being challenged, a criminal charge has been filed against you, and that's been on that statute's been on the books for 15, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years, and there hasn't been even a challenge attempt before you, it almost seems like you're trying to dodge responsibility and delay, and you're not going to get the full workup in most of those situations. You're going to file a motion, some sort of pretrial motion, saying that the registry is... that aspect is unconstitutional, and you're trying to stop your prosecution, and most of the time the judge is going to say, good luck, no dice, and keep going. Now, I've mumbled quite a bit and rambled. Chance, what would your thoughts be on my observations?
Well, just about the same. I mean, you know, and then beyond that, you know, you've got to decide where you're going to start. You got to pick your court. You know, we're going to start it in a federal court. What federal court? You're going to start in a state court. What state court? There's a lot of questions about, you know, what it is, what aspect you're challenging, and what court you're going to do it in. It's a strategy call. So it's not a really simple equation. It's actually a really complex equation, and would take longer than this segment is geared for to really get into the mechanics of it.
A question over on Discord came in. Someone says, at what point in time does the level of requirements to be met for the registry cross over into punitive?
Well, now that's a tough one. And you would need to analyze the case law that's developed in your jurisdiction, either federal or state. You know, if you're going to take it into state court, you would need to look at the decisions that are already in existence. All the things that have been previously that were a part of your registration scheme that were required and have been upheld at an appellate level, that those are not going to be magically overturned because you don't like them and you're coming back to court. So think about this way. The Court of Appeals, for example, I think universally around the country, they divide into panels so they can handle all of the voluminous amount of work that flows to them. And one panel will not overrule another panel because you would have chaos if that were the case. So if there's an existing panel decision from an appellate level court or Supreme Court, those challenges are not going anywhere unless you have significantly different facts. So if they add one additional horrendous disability or restraint that hasn't previously been litigated, then that would be potentially the point, but that would be potentially a tipping point. But you've got to look at what's already been upheld before you mount your challenge, because if you don't, they're going to look at you and say, why are we here? This has already been decided. This issue has already been decided.
This would be where disabilities and restraints can be brought up, that type of thing, to figure out if it's punitive?
Well, that's the essence of the question when he says that the level of requirements. The registry, the requirements that you provide information, those are never going to be unconstitutional, in my opinion, except for possibly the online publication, the publication of all your personal information. But if they collect an additional piece of information, there's no disability involved in that. You have to give them the information. So if they add email addresses, well, you might be getting into a territory there where you could argue that it's impairing your anonymous speech. But if they add something much more innocuous, you're not going to get anywhere with that. But if they tell you you've never had a residency restriction and they say, by the way, starting July 1st, you can't live within 1,000 feet of a school, that becomes more problematic because that is truly a disability. And it's going to be very problematic if they tell you that you have to leave your existing residence that you've been already been residing at for a long time. So it's going to be a case-by-case analysis of what they add and what the appellate case law looks like in the jurisdiction where those requirements have been enhanced.
Anything else you want to add to that, Chance?
No, I mean, I think, you know, Larry makes a very good point, which is, you know, if you're going to duplicate an effort that's already been denied, that's a waste of time and money. I mean, if you've got something that's a first impression and unique in that way, whole different table. But if the table's already been set by precedent and what you're bringing up has already been decided, yeah, it doesn't make much sense trying to push it again. And there's always a caveat, unless you've got something new and compelling.
Another question that just came along is, but what if I have no residency restrictions in my town, but I want to move to a town in the same state that does? Would that be considered a disability?
That's a fun question. And I would say I don't know the answer to that, because that is not the registry. That's the town. And they're merely using the registry as the basis for imposing the disability restraint. So if you were to bring that case to me, I would tell you honestly, we don't know. If that town passed that restriction after you were convicted, and it's truly an ex post facto requirement, if I were the state, I would argue, well, yeah, it was passed 4 years after he was convicted, but we've got 58,876 square miles and 159 counties here he can live in. So he doesn't have to live there. He's not being banished from the entire state of Georgia. So I just don't know what the answer to that would be.
Compare that to, gosh, whatever it was, 2015 or 16, where Texas was trying to do things, and what is it called, home rule, where if your town is smaller than X, you have to follow the rules of the state. You're not allowed to make your own rules. Did I describe that halfway well?
You did.
How would, like, is that a unique situation being in Texas? Are there other states that have similar things? Do all states have similar things?
Well, we have similar rules, but what had happened in Texas is that the home rule municipalities, those 5,000 or less, I believe the threshold was, they were not allowed to regulate PFRs, but the larger cities were. So those small non-home rule cities, like they were not large, were not allowed to do that. And so an attorney made that challenge that they didn't have the authority. They were preempted by state law. And I said, well, have fun with that challenge. They're simply going to change the law. I mean, there's no way of rule-based legislature where you got the urban centers of Dallas and Houston and San Antonio and Austin. But Texas is very rural because it's so large. There's no way that those lawmakers who represent those rural areas are going to be able to look their constituents in the face and say, yeah, we trust the people in Houston to make good decisions about how they can regulate PFRs, but we ain't going to give our small town administrators and mayors and councilors that kind of power because they just don't know how to use it. Can you imagine how long you'd stay in office if you took that position? So they just simply changed the law and they gave the non-home rule cities the same prerogative that the home rule cities have.
And to close that out, so they'll basically keep pushing and pushing and pushing until the point where they find where it becomes something challengeable, and then it's on us to prove that it's unconstitutional to push it back to something less bad, and it's never going to go away, but it would just be less bad.
Now, I don't think I would say it's never going to go away. I always keep eternal optimism. I think that the population has the capacity to become enlightened and wake up and insist on sound public policy, but the courts cannot save us from poor, bad policy choices. That's the freedom of living in a democratic society, is you can impose things that are less than ideal on yourselves if you choose to.
We should elect a dictator and we'll just be done with it.
And we choose to elect people who promise us they're going to be harsh, and then we're shocked when they're harsh. And I've not been able to process it in my head and understand it. Why do you find it surprising that they do what they promised you they would do in terms of being tough on crime and being hard-nosed? And then they whine and they wring their hands and they say, well, why did we get this? I said, well, you did vote for it.
The guy running says he'll be a dictator at least for a day, right? So we would vote in the guy that could be a dictator. Right, Chance?
That's how long it takes to set everything up. Just approximately one day. So.
All right, moving along. I recently, this is a follow-up to the segment we did last or 2 weeks ago about the GBI investigation and harassing phone calls. So I recently contacted the Juro Bureau of Investigation after receiving a second harassing spam call at my workplace, the company store I manage. The scammer, posing as Lieutenant Ross, used the National PFR Registry to target me, claiming I was under investigation and needed to contact them immediately. Despite our strict company policy against sharing personal information, they used my work address listed on the registry to impersonate law enforcement and attempt extortion by demanding payment for a fictitious bond.
I ask you to bring this question back because subsequent to that episode, we heard from a listener in Illinois, and we validated that listener saying that there was information on the national website that was not listed in Illinois on the website in terms of employment. And it seemed to check out on more than one PFR registered in Illinois. And that may in fact be the case in Georgia. I'm not going to sit down and go through every registrant in Georgia or even very many of them to try to figure that out. But this in fact may be how that happened. And I was kind of arrogant in the episode saying, well, the information that's on the national website is only the same information because it's merely a connecting search engine that lets you see that state's registration information. It appears that at least Illinois and possibly Georgia are sharing more information with the national search engine than what's actually visible on their own website. So folks, be careful. Make sure that you check yourself and see if the information is different and inconsistent on the national website.
Is that anything challengeable if your state doesn't require it, but if then it's being published elsewhere? Does that pose a threat or something challengeable, I should say?
I have not been able to come up with any challenge because the fact of the matter is it's truthful information. Unless you're what's being listed on the national website is not accurate, I mean, you might find an attorney that's very bored and has so much money they have that they can blow a lot of billable hours on this. But trying to say, chance you're an attorney, if someone came to you and said, "Hey, I'm wanting to challenge this. California doesn't require it to be published, but yet when I search myself nationally, it's showing up on the national website." Would you be gung ho to go down with a challenge? And what would your cause of action be if someone prison?
Yeah, I'm not. That's you know, just not my wheelhouse. I would refer them to other attorneys who do that type of work. And but my gut feeling is that I'm not sure very many would be wanting to challenge that for the same reason you just stated. You know, if it's true information, it's being shared, there's, you know, you're running into, you know, First Amendment issues I don't think you can overcome.
So, well, I wanted to let people know that I certainly don't know at all. What I do know is that the person who directs the registry in the state has testified no less than a handful of times, possibly more than a handful of times in the year since Adam Walsh Act passed. And part of her assertions are the reason why New Mexico should become AWA compliant is because our website is deficient and they're not allowed to share any information because it is simply a search tool that connects people in one location to a state's registration service to the website. And I've heard that 5-6 times at least in testimony. And I assumed if the director of the registration said it's merely a search engine, I assumed that that was accurate testimony. It might not be, or it might just be an anomaly in Illinois and possibly in Georgia, but that's what I was always told.
Very well. I am going to move over and we're going to read a letter. This is, again, from 2 episodes ago, we covered a person that had a 2-part question. And so this is Daniel's 2nd part. And it goes, "I was on federal supervision in the Northern District of Ohio. My conditions require internet monitoring software. I asked the PO many times, how do I get the monitoring? And he just refused to provide it. He told me that the internet is a privilege that I have to earn and he can take it away at any time. Well, in 2023, one cannot function in society by avoiding the internet. I was unable to apply for jobs, collect unemployment, obtain health care, find a residence, take college courses, and many, 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 many more things. This seems to be the normal policy for the entire district. Everyone I've known in this district experienced the same issue. Is there any way to challenge this, considering the internet is a necessity now? How are we expected to survive and function without it?" I love this question, Larry.
I do as well. That's why I gave this person a 50-year subscription to the transcripts, because it was such a good set of questions. So that means we have to keep this program alive for 50 more years.
All right, then.
Perfect.
And looking at that question, I think that he has a magnificent potential challenge, assuming everything he's saying is correct, and I have no reason to doubt it, because you can't function. When I go into all the places that are begging for help, not a single one hands out paper applications anymore. Does anybody see a paper application being handed out anymore?
I have no idea.
Well, they're very rare. You know, they direct you to a terminal to apply, or they tell you to go go online to our website at Taco Bell, jobs.tacobell, whatever. They direct you to go apply online. And as a condition of supervised release or any supervision, you're generally required to work, maintain appropriate employment. So if you can't search for a job in the modern era, that would seem to run contrary to one of the most basic conditions of rehabilitation and reintegration, is holding a steady job. So Andy, would you finally admit that this is funny? Because if you are required to work and they won't let you look for a job, is that funny or not?
No, not funny. I don't know why you keep thinking this shit's funny. This is not funny.
Well, then how would you describe it? If you're required to work and they won't let you look for work, what would be a better description of it than being funny?
All the words that I would use for this, Larry, is particularly like while you're on supervision, you're required to have a job. Yet, they're going to refuse you the tools you need to go get a job And then they would say, we're going to have to lock you up for not complying because you didn't get a job. Okay, that's funny. No, it's not funny. That's really shitty. No, that's not funny.
Kind of funny.
Not if you're the one that can't do it.
Correct.
But it's a lot deeper than that. There's so many things when you're living in a society in modern times that you just really can't do without access to the internet. You're just hopelessly lost if you can't get online. And so, Chance, the question I would pose to you is, imagine you're in a federal court district in California, someone on federal supervised release, and they bring this question to you. Would you be more comfortable with asking the judge to clarify to the probation service that the internet monitoring is not an option? What would you think would be the most least risky option? Because there's a risk with everything you do. If you file something and probation service has to come to court, they're not going to like you very much. But what would you advise a client?
Well, that's interesting you ask, because I was just there yesterday doing something very similar. What I guess I would ask for a modification based on the fact that it doesn't really reasonably relate to the conviction itself, because if it did, I wouldn't be there, because there would be a stronger case in regulating. But let's just say that we take everything as true and it doesn't. It doesn't reasonably relate to the conviction. Then yes, I mean, you're ordered to either be employed, be in school, and a dozen other things you've got to do, but all of which, depend on access to the internet. And it just totally defeats the purpose of that condition. So the argument here is you're asking somebody to do something, you're putting a condition on them, and, with the threat of repercussions, structure. And so, in order to enable them to do what the condition calls for, and at the same time, rehabilitate, okay, which is a big thing for judges, doing that type of thing, a modification, a real explanation from probation is necessary. And, modifying to, limit the condition or eliminate the condition is completely I would say a reasonable thing to do.
So you would not be hesitant if the person didn't have a really strong, if the probation service couldn't make a really strong case that this was a unique and egregious case, that such access would be dangerous for society, you would go back to the judge and say, clarify and allow access. Because it's so ridiculous. When my boss's mother died, I was trying to close out accounts with, like, for example, whatever the electric company is out in Southern California where she was. And I called the electric company and they wouldn't even take the phone call. And you had to punch options. And I pressed the option that said discontinue service. And they said, oh, you pressed option 3, disconnect service. Go online and put in your account number and you can terminate service. you can't even turn off your electricity by calling the electric company anymore on the phone.
And then Larry thinks that's funny. Would you move into a place? I know, right? How would you even establish utilities without having a phone?
You wouldn't. Like I say, there's so many things. You get your doctor's appointments by phone, by internet, online. I haven't been able to get a statement from some dental work. They don't send statements anymore. They tell you to go log in. And you go log in to the link they send you, and it tells you how much you owe. It doesn't tell how they got to the story, which is a separate component. But I have to go online to figure out what I owe, to pay what I owe, and to do anything related to my dental account.
Does a person like this have any option of relief? Like, we use the word vehicle earlier. Is there anything? I mean, you're going to go piss off a bunch of people in the process.
Yes, that's the only option he has. It's going to have to go back to the sentencing judge or whoever's got it. It may not be the same sentencing judge, depending on if the judge has died or sure. Something. But he'll have to go back to the judge as jurisdiction and ask for a modification, clarification. And Chance said that's what he would advise. I would go along with that advice, but I'm telling you, if you do it, they're not going to have a sense of humor about it. The probation service.
They're not going to be like Larry. They are going to be pissed. That's right.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
All right, well, let's move along before this podcast takes us 7 years. I found an article in my normal stream of things, and it's a very sciencey one. It's from Scientific American, which discusses the flaws in a widely used criminal justice algorithm called CP, y'all can figure out what that part is, Offender Risk Tool, or CPORT. And the article raised a whole bunch of concerns about the validity and the accuracy of this tool, which is often used to estimate the risk of recidivism among CP offenders.
So what's the main issue with the CPORT algorithm as you see it?
So first of all, the CPORT was developed using a very small sample size, and it was only 266 people from Ontario, Canada. And I got to think that the people way over there are not the same as we are here. I'm actually not being serious about that part. The problem is that these were people being released from prison in Canada from 1993 to 2006. And so out of these, only 29 were charged with or convicted with a new PFR type offense within 5 years. This small sample size makes the statistical models unstable and not generalized to be available to the broader population.
Yeah, that's a significant problem. It's kind of like the static 99. Same problem with it. Isn't sample size crucial for the reliability of any statistical model? I mean, with such a small number, it's hard to make accurate predictions.
And that's exactly right. And size matters, as we all know. Furthermore, the data used to develop CPORT is outdated since it was developed in the mid-90s when Al Gore was just in the finishing stages of inventing the internet. It doesn't account for technological advancements since 2006, like the widespread use of cell phones and the internet in general, which have drastically changed how CP offenses are even committed. Can you imagine, like, in 1993, people were swapping Polaroids, probably.
So the algorithm is essentially working with outdated information, which means it's not accurately assessing the risk of today's context. Is that what you're saying here?
That's exactly correct. And even the validation study they conducted was flawed. They only validated it with 80 offenders from the same jurisdiction in Ontario, and the results were inconsistent. So what they're saying is there, if you build a model that says, here's what we're going to do to predict it, and then you turn around and you go try to evaluate it with somebody new, you try to see if your model can predict, and that wasn't working out for them. The algorithm's predictive power varied depending on whether cases with missing information were included.
Yeah, this inconsistency is alarming. I mean, a reliable algorithm should produce consistent results regardless of minor variations in the data set. These inconsistencies suggest that the CPORT isn't robust and might be very biased.
What about independent studies? Have they confirmed these findings?
You mean independent studies like the one from Spain? They also had sample sizes, small sample sizes, incomplete data. None of these studies were conducted on U.S. offenders, which further questions the applicability of CPORT in the United States.
Yeah, it sounds like there could be a selection bias. You know, how were individuals chosen for the study?
That's a really excellent point, Chance. The article doesn't mention how they were the individuals were selected, which means there could be a selection bias. This happens when the sample isn't representative of the broader population, possibly because certain types of offenders were more likely to be included in the study than others. This bias can distort the algorithm's predictions, making it, again, unreliable when applied to a different group of people.
Well, this raises significant ethical concerns, in my opinion. Using an unvalidated algorithm can lead to unjust outcomes. Non-dangerous offenders might receive harsher punishment sentences, while dangerous ones could be released prematurely. This undermines the integrity of the justice system.
Precisely. And it doesn't just affect individual cases. It also can erode public trust in the justice system. People need to believe that the legal decisions were based on accurate and fair assessments.
That's actually like the crux of the issue. The continued use of CPORT, despite its flaws, illustrates the dangers of relying on unvalidated risk assessment tools. Until these tools are rigorously tested and validated in the jurisdictions where they are applied, their use remains problematic and potentially harmful.
So what should be done to ensure these algorithms are properly validated?
So steps to ensure proper validation include conducting large-scale studies with diverse and representative samples, peer-reviewing the methodologies and findings, and continuously updating the algorithm to reflect new data and technological advancements. Transparency in how these algorithms operate is also crucial. Larry, I think you'll have significant insight into this next, what we need to have done.
Well, sure. And policymakers need to balance the need for immediate tools with the necessity for developing accurate and validated algorithms. And investing in research and development is key, and we should avoid quick fixes that lack scientific backing. And I'll go off script here a little bit, and there it always raises a financial question for funding. When you're trying to do these studies, you're competing for funding within the budgetary process, and some would argue that a small study of 286 is better than having no information, because otherwise we still have to sentence these people. We still have to do something with these people. So would your position be that we should just, without any studies, just keep flying by the seat of our pants, or would this be better than nothing?
I would be inclined to say that it would be better to have nothing, because you don't want to sentence somebody to 1,000 years that doesn't necessarily deserve it.
You know, it's also important to look at alternatives. The public safety assessment algorithm, for example, has been validated across multiple jurisdictions with large and diverse data sets. Developing localized risk assessment tools can also offer more accurate and fair assessments. And they do this in California with respect to instruments used in forensic and psychological testing.
Absolutely. Ensuring that risk assessment instruments are validated and reliable is crucial for meaningful and lasting criminal justice reform. Only then can we trust these tools to make fair and accurate legal decisions.
Good article.
Anything? Yeah, it was cool. I'm a huge fan of statistics and science stuff, too. You ready for this Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals?
I am indeed. I've been studying this decision intently for 2 weeks now.
I believe it. And so we're going to discuss this case about a PFR victory being, wait for it, overturned. Or our Tennessee listeners will be very disappointed. So are you ready for that?
I think so.
All right. In an opinion filed May 15th, the Sixth... I hate saying the word Sixth. Sixth Circuit held that Tennessee's entire registry law cannot be thrown out because a handful of requirements may be unconstitutional. The decision vacated an injunction granted by U.S. District Judge Alita Trauger. Judge Trauger had ruled in plaintiff's favor on Does 1 through 5 versus Snyder. Oh my God, 834 Federal 3rd, 696, 6th Circuit, 2016? How did I do?
Good.
Okay. This can't be good. And what went wrong, Larry?
Well, what went wrong, my initial thoughts after reading the opinion, is that the Sixth Circuit is conveying very clearly that they did not strike down registration entirely in the state of Michigan in Doe versus Snyder. And that's what Judge Trauger relied on so heavily. And I think they're conveying, don't overread what we did in 2016. But let's see what Chance has to say.
Well, you know, after skimming that decision thoroughly, if anyone could ever do that, I tend to agree.
Did you skim it thoroughly?
Skim it thoroughly. But, you know, I did notice as I was skimming it thoroughly and looking at other comments on it, Larry's written about this. Larry's done a lot of thinking about this. So I would refer or defer to Larry for elaboration on this point.
Well, the opinion listed in chronological order the many amendments and enhancements added to Tennessee's registration law since 1995. The plaintiffs allege that Tennessee's imposition of these enhanced requirements against them violates the Constitution's ex post facto clause. They filed an action for declaratory and injunctive relief against Governor Lee and Tennessee Bureau of Investigation Director Rausch, asking the court to prohibit the state from enforcing the act. What's wrong with that?
Nothing conceptually. The problem is that the plaintiff's attorneys were overreading the Doe versus Snyder decision from Michigan. That's the problem, but there's nothing wrong with trying to use Doe versus Snyder to tame the beast. I would suggest every state and every advocacy within the Sixth Circuit look very carefully at Doe versus Snyder, but don't put stuff in it that's not there.
Yeah, because if you read the fine print, they really didn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, right, Larry?
That is correct.
So what's the reason Governor Lee was removed and TBI Director Rausch is the lone party now?
Well, again, I wish I were had direct pipelines to the attorneys. I don't know what their position and their theory was for naming the governor. I would be very hesitant to name a governor because governors don't run day-to-day operations. So the governor of Tennessee has no idea what the registry does, who's on it or anything about it, and is not involved with it. I don't know if that was supposed to be impressive and say, well, if we name the governor, that will surely include everybody down the food chain, because it does not. So when they looked at Tennessee law, they figured out that the governor is ceremonial, but really doesn't have any direct control over the registry. So he was removed. But TBI Director Rausch is in control and does have a fair amount of say-so in Tennessee's registration system. So he is a remaining party. That's not to say that they couldn't amend later and bring in and plead in new parties. And Chance might be able to expand on that. But you can ask that a party's been removed. If there's an appropriate party, it's conceivable that since this case has been remanded, that they could ask, you know, to bring in a new party.
Plaintiffs argued that Tennessee's registry law is identical to Michigan's SORA in the Snyder case. And what's wrong with that concept, Larry?
Well, it doesn't matter that the Tennessee registry is nearly identical. What matters is the Sixth Circuit did not deem Michigan's registry to be unconstitutional in its entirety. As I stated, too many people want to overread what the court has determined. That circuit opinion said very clearly that we have previously upheld registration in Michigan, but when you did what you did in 2006 and 2011, you went too far in terms of the ex post facto clause. In the 2006, I think the 2006 was when they put in the proximity restrictions. And I think 2011 is when Michigan went substantially AWA compliant, and they put people in the tier designations, and those who ended up in tier three are lifetime without any due process. And they said, you can't do these things. But saying you can't be a lifetime registrant without due process is not anything like saying that you can't be forced to register. How can you interpret that way?
The Sixth Circuit noted that the district court, and this is from Judge Trauger, took a similar view, treating Snyder as a case dealing with Michigan's SORA in its entirety, and seemed to imply that the panel, in Snyder, enjoined the entire law, and repeatedly characterized Snyder as a broadly enjoining the Michigan law. Are you implying that Judge Trauger got it wrong? Are you so bold, Larry, that you would think that you could say a judge got it wrong?
Well, I don't really need to imply that because the Sixth Circuit stated, quote, this is incorrect. In Snyder, we evaluated only the 2006 and 2011 amendments to SORA, amendments prohibiting offenders from living, working, or lording within 1,000 feet of a school, and requiring immediate in-person appearance to update critical information. And that's in the opinion on page 10. So I will trust them if they say that Judge Trauger got it wrong. Those are the portions of the law. They also categorizing offenders and prohibiting them from working and travel within certain zones. Those claims are still standing, and they will go forward on remand. But the Sixth Circuit is very clear. Don't say we struck down Michigan's registry, because we didn't.
Correct. They will go forward on remand in a very limited way to determine the constitutionality of the newly added provisions.
So, folks, just when you read an opinion, don't try to invent things that you wish it says. Because people do that all the time. I remember many years ago when I first got into this advocacy on the PFR issue, a person had, I think it was in Pennsylvania, and he was in Maryland. He says, I'm going to move to Pennsylvania. He said, PFRs that are homeless don't have to register in Pennsylvania. And I said, well, really? He said, yeah, the Supreme Court said that in Pennsylvania. I said, really? Let me take a look at that. And I looked at it, and it said that the PFR that was homeless did not have to provide an address. So I called him back, and I said, well, the way I read this, it says that a homeless person cannot be jailed for failing to provide an address. I said, where does it say you don't have to register? He said, well, you can read between the lines. It clearly, if you don't have a place, you don't have to register. I said, well, what about your fingerprints? What about your DNA? What about anything else that you're required to do? What about all that stuff? They can take your picture. They can do a whole lot of things. Why is it that you can conclude because you don't have to provide a physical address that you don't have to register? I said, they didn't say that. But people tend to do that all the time.
Shall we move along to the Chance Hour and go to California Corner?
Of course, because we want to get out of here so you can go to the game.
Right.
Okay.
Chance, take it away, sir.
Let's go to sunny California. Now, listen, gentlemen, jump in wherever you want. I'm going to remind people that this is California Corner, Certificate of Rehabilitation Part 2. We did Part 1, I believe, last time. This episode is about how to apply. The last episode was about what is a certificate of rehabilitation and who's eligible for it, who can apply. Today, how to apply. And so following up, the first thing I think everybody should know is they should consider getting legal help because this is kind of a confusing area in terms of procedure. Now, you can do this on your own without a lawyer. There's nothing that says you must have one. But I think you should consider getting help with the process. And during the proceedings in court, you have an absolute right to a lawyer of your choice or a public defender who's a lawyer who works in the public defender's office. Okay, the next thing to consider is get your criminal record and find out what forms you need. That's the first step, really. And in California, to get a copy of your criminal record is fairly easy. You can get this from the California Department of Justice. And you will need this information to complete your petition. A lot of people call me about this, and they need it for other things as well. They would say, what do I do? How do I know what my criminal history is? Well, it's pretty easy. You know, you just use the life scan form found online. online, which means
online.
You need to use a computer at the CADOJ website. Yeah, now I say that, and it's kind of funny, but yeah, I mean, you could probably get the same form at FedEx. If you really wanted to, because they probably have them there. Check on the form record review as the type of application, because if you don't, they're not going to do it. Enter record review on the reason for the application line. So it's a record review. That's what you're putting on that form. A lot of people get messed up there. Fill out your personal information. Take the completed form to any live scan site for fingerprinting services. Well, you know, FedEx does it right there, but, you know, you can do it. Fingerprinting services are available at most local law enforcement agencies, including the ones that you may register at or any public applicant live scan site such as FedEx. Okay. And let me say one other thing. You know, people might ask, well, why is that so important? Why do I need that? Well, because it really says, and, you know, it says, as far as your criminal history is concerned in California, exactly what the DA is going to look up and find out. So you might as well see if it's accurate or not. And it will help you understand and assess your background for purposes of doing this form, because it's going to, because either the DA's office is going to ask you to list prior felony convictions. And you're also going to be asked on the forms that you fill out and file with the court. So this is an important step. And it's an excellent step to take if you're going to have an attorney assist you, because that attorney might want to look and corroborate exactly what you're saying. Okay, so I have here the next step to go online and contact the court. Go online or contact the court to find out what forms you need. Now, what I mean by this is each court is required to have forms for your use. They often come with additional instructions. Okay, so courts, they have them at the courts, at the criminal court clerk's office in the particular court you're going to, or you can go online. And usually they have them online. You can just download them, print them out. But you want to contact the court or public defender where you live or where the convictions happen to ask how you can get the forms. That's important. And we're really only talking about three forms, and that will become clear in a minute. So you want to fill out these forms and make copies. And the two forms I'm going to talk about right now are petition and notice. The petition is just the body asking, you know, you're requesting relief. The notice is letting other folks who need to know what you're doing, that you're doing this. So that's what those two forms are about. So you want to gather supporting documents and attach them to your petition. And I say that because most people think, I'll just fill out these forms and I'll file them and that should be enough. No, it's not enough. Okay, what you want to do, for example, is you want to get letters of support. You want to attach psychological assessments if they're positive, certificates from classes or programs you've completed, or proof of education or employment to show that you've turned your life around, because rehabilitation means I've turned my life around so significantly that the court should declare that I'm rehabilitated. You want to include those with your petition, and I'll speak to notice in just a moment. You want to make copies of your petition. The original petition is for the court. You want to keep a copy for yourself and provide copies to the district attorney's and governor's office. In filing the forms, let's talk about file forms, because that's the next step. You want to file the forms in the Superior Court in the county where you live or in the county where you were convicted. So you have two options. If you're living in San Francisco, but you were convicted in Los Angeles, you've got two places where you can file. Okay, after you decide where you're going to file, you want to give notice of your court date. Okay, and that's post-filing. So after filing the notice and petition and receiving a court date, you must officially let the district attorney and the governor's office know about the court date. You got to invite them to the party. And that has to be done at least 30 days before your court date. So you must formally notify the district attorney and the governor's office about the court date. This is done by serving them notice of your court date. Note, and this is really, really important, you must notify the district attorney in the county where you filed the petition and the district attorney in the county where you were originally convicted if they are two separate places. I would also just suggest, and this is what I referred to earlier, attaching a copy of your petition to the notice, because the notice is just one page. What you want to do is attach a copy of that, okay? And the reason being is because you're going to load that copy with all kinds of wonderful letters and support and all kinds of other evidence to show that you rehabilitated, because those parties that you're sending those petitions out to can come to court and object. And what you want to do is you want to defeat that before you get to court. You don't want to have a whole bunch of folks running in and saying, don't do it, and that we object to it. So the best thing to do is attach your petition and show them that there's no need for them to show up and object. Okay, now who can serve and how to serve the court papers? If you're doing it yourself, someone 18 years old or older, not you, must deliver a copy of the notice. The person who delivers the copies is called a server, usually a process server. The server can deliver the papers in person or by mail.
Okay. Chance, can I interrupt? I have a story to tell you about this.
Tell me that story.
Oh my God. So I got out in 2014, and in that window, I was trying to get a modification that I was allowed to be around my child. And I'm dealing with my attorney that defended me, and I'm offering whatever I can do to help out. You let me know. She goes, here, run this paperwork to the judge. This is the sentence modification that says that you're allowed to be around your child. So I take it down there. I go down to the courthouse, and I'm sitting there in the judge's secretary's office, and the judge is just in the room over there. And she looks at the paperwork, the secretary does, and she's like, is this you? And I said, yes, ma'am. And I'm dressed in like khakis and a polo shirt. I'm dressed presentable. And she says, okay. I mean, I don't think anything at all is happening. Next thing I know, a very large female, like deputy, whatever, like courthouse officer comes in and she says, you come with me. And I'm like, okay. And we're walking down the judge's chambers, hallway, whatever. And there's a cop on the other end running at me at full blast. And I said,
wow.
Is he coming for me? And she says, yes. I'm like, what did I do? You guys let me in. When I got to the courthouse, they're behind a secured wall. or a doorway, and you got to like go up to it. There's a camera. You go, "Hi, I'm here delivering paperwork for Judge so and so," and they go, "Eh," and you pull the door and you walk in. Like, they let me in. So anywho, right. Next thing you know, like, I am surrounded by like six officers, and they are about to like pounce on me, and they're like, "Why are you in here?" I'm like, "Yeah, let me in. I was filing the my attorney said come down here," and they're like, "It was not supposed to be you." Next thing you know, though, I'm in whatever his, like, the deputy in charge of the security force there at the courthouse. I'm in his office. He's got guitars all over the place. I'm talking to him about music and whatnot. And he personally hand runs the paperwork to the judge to get it signed for me. And then I was out the door.
That's a pretty extraordinary story.
And it's funny. But I lived. It is funny. It wasn't funny at the time. I was petrified.
That's interesting. What do you think about that, Larry?
It's not quite the same situation. We're talking about service of process, and you're talking about you were effectively a law firm runner, and you ran your own paperwork down. But yeah, this is not quite the same thing, but it is a funny story.
But Chan said someone 18 or older, not you. That's
what
made me think
of it. Yeah, it's similar, and it does bring back, you know, it does bring back memories for you, Andy, and it's demonstrative of what I'm saying, which is not you, and it means not you. You know, in this case, it could really, you know, get in the way of you know, an efficient process here and stall things for quite a while, you know. So, but, you know, moving on, how to file that proof of service once the server delivers the notices. And again, I'll remind everybody, notices are just a sheet of paper saying that this is the court date and this is what it pertains to. That's why it's so important to attach a petition to it. But once that happens, the server can fill out and sign the affidavit of service by mail or notice of service in person. And that's included in that one sheet of notice. And then what you want to do is make a copy and file the original in the court. It's just a single sheet showing who was served and by whom. That's it. So far, we're talking about three separate documents. We're talking about a petition, we're talking about notice, and we're talking about the notice of service, which is separate. Okay, respond to any request is the next step, and that's depending on the county where you applied. There may be more forms to fill out. For example, the district attorney may want to complete an investigative application for pre-hearing investigation, looking into what you've done since your release. So they may have a form that you fill out talking about your entire life and everything you do, own, and have done since your conviction. And usually these things are extensive. And this is where it's really, you know, a good thing to have legal counsel involved, because this sometimes could be tricky. And sometimes a wrong answer can lead to bad things, not good things. So you got to really be careful about how you fill out that form. The other thing is that once you do fill out that form, if there's an investigation, it's going to take a little time. It's also good to have legal counsel, because they then, based on the conclusions from the form and based on your petition, may want to meet with the district attorney to say, eliminate the possibility of the district attorney objecting to your certificate of rehabilitation. And if that's done, then that's really good, because it just makes it very easy then for you to pronounce, you know, for you to declare to the court why you think you're rehabilitated, or for your attorney to do it. And during that hearing, you can have witnesses testify to your good character and highlight letters of recommendation, employment history, community activity and service, and any other evidence you believe will support your request. And with that, I think I've just skimmed under, just slid into home.
I wanted to ask you a question, and just as I was about to formulate the question, it kind of vanished from my head. Can you go over the thing, though, again, with using an attorney to do this, that the attorney can talk to the DA instead of doing pro se? Why is it so beneficial?
Well, it's actually, there's several steps in this that are beneficial. You know, if you look at the procedural steps, it's beneficial because an attorney knows how to do these things so that you don't make the mistake of doing them yourself. The second step is that when you put together your packet, your petition, and you buffer it with all kinds of good things you've done in letters in support, it's good to have someone know how to organize and how to organize what needs to be said in the letters and how to organize everything that follows. And then your question is, after the investigation, let's just say the investigation comes out pretty pristine. And in particular cases, sometimes policy dictates that district attorneys object almost all the time. But if you've got somebody who's reasonable and things have worked out in the investigation, and an attorney knows how to negotiate with that district attorney, knows what to do, it may be that the objection is either watered down, the DA may submit based on your conversations with them, may not object at all. So, it's very wise to have someone who can work those things out, because if you try to do it yourself, you're probably going to end up making things worse more than anything else.
Got it. Okay.
Well, that was what I was going to say. It's really hard to talk about yourself in a way that sounds rational. It's kind of like if you watch a person that represents themselves, well, did you see me there? it's like when you're putting forth the presentation, my client has been exemplary. Since release from prison, my client has achieved X, Y, and Z. It's really awkward saying, since release from prison, Your Honor, I have done this. And it's a whole different ballgame. And plus, you can have conversations with the prosecution and figure out where their pressure points are. As an individual, you're going to be limited in those conversations because, A, the prosecution's not going to want to talk to you. And if B, if they do talk to you, they're not going to tell you what they really feel about you, but they'll tell the attorney most of the time.
Correct.
All right. I think that we've about had it for the day.
I agree. This is a perfect 1-hour episode.
This is right on the 1-hour mark. I am going to bid all of the people that decided to come hang out with us on a Friday afternoon, bid you all adieu, and thank you very much for coming and hanging out, because it was I appreciate having people to keep poking fun at Larry and his oldness while we record. But head over to registrymatters.co to find the show notes. You can leave voicemail at 747-2277. 4477, email at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And then you can always call Chance at 949-365-5842. Even if you just want to chit chat, he's there for you. Lastly,
that's right.
If you're feeling generous, go over to patreon.com/registrymatters and support for as little as $1 a month. And that is very much appreciated, sharing and showing the love. And you get the podcast early. The normal people are going to get this on Tuesday after Labor Day, or Memorial Day, excuse me. And the patrons are going to get it probably tomorrow. So without anything else, Chance, as always, enjoy your weather out there. I'm very jealous, and I hope you have a fantastic holiday weekend.
Thank you. Thank you.
You too. And Larry, you do the same. And I hope you have a great weekend.
Thank you.
You've been listening to FYP.